Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Mobile hunters, are you looking to make the move to saddle hunting this year? Or maybe you just want to add a few new pieces of gear or upgrade your current saddle gear? If that's the case, then head over to tetherednation.com, where they've got all mobile hunters covered. Whether you're new to saddle hunting or an old timer, Tethered is your one-stop saddle shop. From saddles to ropes, sticks, ascenders, whatever it is you need, they have you covered. I've personally been using their gear for the past three seasons. Now, my base setup consists of the Phantom saddle and the Predator platform. And if you're wondering why I've chosen to use their gear above all else, here's the cliff notes. They're innovative and pushing the mobile hunting forward overall. They cut no corners and prioritize the safety and performance of their gear. They care about the community that they've created, and their gear allows me to hunt free. And above all else, I like to support good people doing good work. If you're interested in upping your mobile hunting game, then head to tetherednation.com. This podcast is brought to you by Skull Brew Coffee Company. Skull Brew Coffee roasts premium single origin coffee, guaranteed to deliver the freshest coffee directly to your doorstep. The kicker? They're 2% for conservation certified and donate 10% of their proceeds back to organizations who support the interests of our hunting community. So go to skullbrewcoffee.com and pick up one of their 3-killer roasts and fuel your hunt and fill more tags with Skull Brew Coffee. Welcome to the Truth from the Stand Deer Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Skull Brew Coffee Company. I'm your host, Clint Campbell, and you're listening to episode number 243. Today, we are talking with Travis Keith, a quiet public land killer from Oklahoma. So stay tuned. What is up, everyone? Happy Wednesday to you. Hope you're doing well. Hope you are feeling fine. I was actually just looking at the calendar, trying to figure out exactly how much longer I have until my whitetail season kicks off. I think from the time that this podcast launches, I will have right around 4.5 weeks until I am with bow in hand and in the timber chasing whitetails. It's hard to believe that it's almost already here. Bunch of folks out there getting started even before that with some of those states that open up either beginning September, you know, or if you're headed out west to antelope hunt, you'll be cranking up here even sooner than that. I think antelope comes in sometime around the end of August. So right now, man, I am just literally watching cell camera pictures roll in, getting super stoked. I actually got up this morning and flung some arrows with my bow because it was one of those mornings where it just kind of felt, you know, I don't want to say that the weather has turned, but we had a pretty nasty hot spell here in PA. And so we just had some nice cool weather that kind of rolled in. It was one of those nice cooler mornings where it just felt good to be out flinging some arrows with the bow. And so that's what I did in the backyard this morning. And then also today, just to kind of get my mind right, I ordered a bunch of lithium batteries. Cause at this point now it'll be, you know, a check of the cameras here sometime after that August 22nd ish timeframe.
And then it will also, you know, be at the same time kind of time to move those, but then additionally kind of put out the remainder of the arsenal in those, you know, fall specific kind of areas, and really kind of get ready for the season. Sad to say, locally, I don't really have anything to speak of in terms of a deer that I might want to try to go after. But it's not surprising. That's kind of been the MO, and I haven't really checked any of the cameras around here other than a couple of the cell cameras, and they're in some harder to reach places that are really more kind of probably October-ish, mid-October kind of time frame areas. And so not surprised that there hasn't been a whole lot kind of come across those cameras, but I do have a card check coming up here in the next couple of weeks. And so at that point, I'll start to really kind of make a game plan, but you know, inventory on some of the other stuff that I scouted this past winter continues to roll in and continues to be positive, I guess is one way to say. And so, you know, I kind of try to let my intel kind of, at least, you know, locally, so to speak, I kind of try to let my intel tell me what my season's going to look like as far as where I'm going to spend time. And it looks like I'm going to be spending more time a little further away from home than I was originally kind of anticipating for this year, which is just as cool, you know, bust out the trailer and get some time in the trailer and live and work out of that and do some bow hunting from that. But not going to belabor this up front, man. You know, before I jump into today's podcast, just want to make quick mention, if you're heading out on a travel hunt or not, but specifically if you're heading out on a travel hunt, head over to skullbrewcoffee.com, pick yourself up some of the backcountry pour over packs so you're not suffering through shitty coffee on your hunting trips. This is killer coffee pour over, better than the rot gut that you'll end up getting from the instant stuff that is out on the market. So skullbrewcoffee.com, use the promo code TFTS21, get yourself some savings for that. And then also head over to the truthofthemstand.com or on my Instagram page and check out the merch I have there. You can use the promo code TFTS21 and get yourself a discount on that as well. So let's get jumped into today's podcast, man. A couple weeks ago, we had Eddie Claypool on, which I'm sure a lot of you guys know who Eddie is. He is a killer, probably one of the best travel public land DIY bow hunters ever. You know, the guy just doesn't have a bad season, it seems like. So whenever he mentioned a fellow by the name of Travis, that it was a buddy of his that he felt was the best public land bow hunter that he knew, I immediately was like, I got to have this guy on the podcast. Actually had a couple of you out there, a couple of listeners reach out and say, hey, when are you going to have Travis on? Wanted to hear from this guy. And so he's by nature kind of a, you know, not real in the, he's not in media or anything like that. And so, you know, I wasn't sure whether or not he would even be willing or interested to come on. He's a pretty private person. So Eddie reached out to him on my behalf to see if he'd be interested in coming on the show. He said yes. And so I was super stoked to have him on. Travis is from Oklahoma, hunts all public land, and really is probably just about one of the most humble guys with that you might meet in terms of a guy who is killing high caliber deer regularly. A lot of what he kind of, I guess, attributes his success to is patience to a degree, but also his access. That's the one thing I picked up from him, is that he's meticulous about his access and will take the path least traveled or hardest traveled to make sure he's getting into an area that's going to be fresh, clean, and give himself the best opportunity. Super awesome guy, great hunter, really killer conversation. I personally was looking forward to doing this show. So hope you guys enjoyed as much as I did. And as always, I want to thank you all for listening. All right, folks, welcome back to another episode of the Truth from the Stand Deer Hunting Podcast. Today, I have on a guest that I just recently learned of. I was turned on to him from a fellow we just recently had on the podcast. We had our buddy Eddie Claypool on, and we just kind of got to talking about, you know, different hunters that he knows that, you know, hunt public land that he thinks are good hunters. And I'm always kind of looking for, you know, guys that maybe, you know, are off the beaten path, so to speak, you know, quiet killers, maybe, as I like to kind of refer to them. And Eddie turned me on to this fella. This is Travis Keith, the man with two first names, is joining me today. How's it going, buddy?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing
appreciate
all right.
Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, man. I appreciate you coming on. I know you're pretty quiet. So, you know, I know whenever I was talking to Eddie and he had mentioned you, and I was like, hey, you know, would you mind reaching out to him and see if he would come on the show? And he was like, I'll talk to him. He's like, but I'm not sure he'll do it. He'll do it. So I appreciate you making time and coming on and chatting. I'm looking forward to chatting with you. I know you and I had a chance to catch up just a little bit on the phone. I guess it was last week. just to kind of connect. Cause it's always kind of weird when you just, the first time you're talking to somebody's on a podcast, right? It just feels kind of weird.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. This is the first for me. So.
Awesome. Well, we're just going to be two dudes talking deer hunting. And so I think you're more than equipped for that. So I think we'll just go ahead and jump in. So I always kind of like to start with a little bit of an icebreaker, so to speak, just to kind of level set folks so they know a little bit about you and a little bit about your background. So if you wouldn't mind, just, you know, tell everyone that's listening, you know, where you're from, what you do for a living.
Yeah. Like you said, my name is Travis Keith. I'm from Northeast Oklahoma. I live, you know, north of Tulsa. I grew up in Owosso, Oklahoma, pretty much my whole life. Currently, I'm like a stationary engineer, kind of boiler chiller operator, you know, operate and maintain, you know, HVAC equipment for a large campus in Tulsa. That's what I've done since I was about 19 at different buildings or properties or whatever, just kind of in the HVAC industry. So
right, nice.
blue collar for sure.
Very nice. Are you by chance, are you a Sooner fan?
Actually, I work for OU. That's the campus I work for. I work for the University of Oklahoma there at the Tulsa campus. So, I like the Sooners football team and softball team, and obviously got to root for them at work. So,
right, you might make some enemies if you don't, right?
Yeah.
Well, because you guys are making some waves here recently, or making some noise with, I think you and Texas possibly leaving for the SEC. That's kind of crazy.
That is very crazy. Yeah. Way beyond my pay scale.
Well, maybe, you know, we have a pretty broad reach on this podcast. They might come talking to you after. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Totally will.
This will actually be a chink in your resume. Actually, we're doing you a disservice. Yeah. You know, there's definitely not getting any promotions after this one. I'm just kidding. So you're in Oklahoma, right? You grew up, born and raised in Oklahoma. How did you start hunting? Like, was it typical, you know, your family was always into hunting and you just kind of fell, you know, followed suit, or was it something a little bit different?
Pretty, you know, semi-typical. You know, we grew up out in the country, you know, so I, you know, kind of had free run of some space, but, as a real young kid, I mean, my dad, he was a squirrel hunter. That was his thing. And he was really good at it. And that's where I learned a lot of just woodsmanship, was going out with him. And, you know, we going out in September and slipping around river bottoms and, you know, just learning how to walk like an Indian, you know, walk silent and look for, you know, leaves shaking and, you know, stuff like that. And he really wasn't like a big game hunter, you know, per se. During some of our adventures, you know, we come across some deer, and that really, I was about seven when I killed my first deer with him, and that opened my eyes to a new world once we, you know, got to try that, you know, for dinner or whatever.
Right.
And I was like, man, I want to go deer hunting now, like squirrel hunting's fun and shooting, you know, dove hunting, you know, and stuff like that. But, and so he started taking me deer hunting, and it was a long time before I, you know, I think I was 13 before I like killed my second deer. And he took me enough to get me hooked. And then, once I was hooked, you know, he just kind of let me go. And, at about age 13, I think that's when I bought my first bow and arrow, just from a pawn shop. I didn't know, you know, I didn't know anything. I didn't know you could adjust the sights or anything like that. I just took it home and started shooting it or whatever. You know, about that time, I got an older brother that I hunt with a lot. And he didn't grow up hunting, you know, as much as I did, but he's about 8 years older than me. So I was 13 and he was, you know, in his early 20s and kind of wanted something to do, you know, something we could do together. So.
Right.
So he got a bow and we just started shooting arrows in the backyard together. And, you know, which eventually led to, you know, I love hunting. I was always in hunting all the time. And he, you know, so he really doesn't like, you know, killing animals and stuff, but,
right.
But he kind of got the bug and we started going, you know, he would take me and we would go, and then we both just kind of got the bug. And mm-hmm. I mean, we've spent a lot of time together, you know, just trying to figure it out over the years.
That's cool. That's always kind of cool, you know, when folks have someone, you know, an older brother or something like that, if, even if they're not super serious or into it, just having that companionship and someone to kind of pal around with.
Yeah, he wasn't in the beginning, you know, but like we're both competitive. I mean, we're both, you know, grew up wrestling. He was a wrestler, a really good wrestler. And so I just, you know, as the son of a welder, the brother of a wrestler, I had to be tough. You know, there wasn't any other choice. So trying to keep up with him and so there's a lot that adds into that, just being mentally tough. There's different things you go through, you know, and having somebody like that there to, like, you know, to push you, or you're competing against, kind of, you know, and you push each other. But now, I mean, yeah, he works as hard as I do, and it's just, you know, we've had a lot of good times for sure.
That's awesome. That you and I have that in common. I was my dad was a welder in the Navy, went to work for a factory back home. I grew up wrestling. So, and then all my cousins, you know, were wrestlers as well. Okay. So, you know, it was, I can understand totally relate the tough upbringing. I mean, there were plenty of cousin fist fights, you know, and thing. I didn't have a brother, but we spent so much time together, you know, our family, where it was, you know, it was pretty rough and tumble. You know, we had a couple different tiers of cousins that we, you know, some of that were fairly older, probably about your brother's age, older than us, you know, where I was probably 13, 14, and they were in like their, you know, 20s or just graduating from high school. And my other cousins that are about my age, we were all, you know, 10, 12, 13, maybe 14 years old. And the older cousins just, I mean, they just whooped our ass pretty much every chance, every chance they got.
Yep.
So that mental toughness, I'm totally familiar with that. But what's the other thing that kind of is funny that struck me when you were talking is that, you know, I've done a lot of podcasts. I think I don't even know what number this is, Travis, that we're doing, like 240 something. And it's funny because a lot of the guys that I get a chance to talk to that I, at least in my experience, that have been really good hunters, a lot of them didn't start out deer hunting, actually. A lot of them started out, you know, and that they didn't have necessarily, like, whether it was their dad or their grandfather kind of getting them into hunting. It wasn't typically, you know, big game related. It was always, you know, hunting squirrels, rabbit hunting, pheasant hunting, like bird hunting of some sort. It was always that kind of smaller game. And maybe that was because that older, you know, the older generation or whatever, maybe that was just a lower barrier to entry for them cost wise and stuff like that. So that was just what they did. But, you know, is there anything that you picked up during that time, you know, that you can kind of think about that it's like that you still use to this day? Maybe might be one way to ask it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, kind of like I mentioned, just, you know, like I remember going, you know, squirrel hunting with my dad. And I mean, like, the main thing he would say when we were slipping through the bottoms is, you know, you got to walk like Indian, you know, and he just meant walk silently.
Right.
Like, don't make noise. You walk slow and don't make noise, you know, and you're always looking, you know, that's a lesson. Me and my friend Jeff, he grew up, you know, kind of hunting with us. And I mean, we still use that when we're, you know, last year when we were in Colorado slipping around, you know, trying to look for elk, you know, like that's always in the back of your mind, you know, when you're still hunting, you know, like, you know, that's just a good lesson.
Yeah.
But you know, like I think, you know, maybe partially to your comments of like some guys just growing up hunting, you know, a little bit of everything, small game to eventually large, is like, you know, you're actually learning how to hunt, you know, on your own. Like if you're hunting a bird, you know, if you're hunting a squirrel or if it's a rabbit or whatever, like you're having to figure it out on your own, like, and grow from that, you know. It's not just, you know, be a 10-year-old kid and, you know, your dad take you out and set you on the food plot and harvest the biggest deer they grew that summer, you know.
Yeah,
which that's awesome. I have cousins that get to do that stuff, you know, and there's two different worlds of hunting, and, you know, they're two different ball games, really, you know. So
yeah,
but that that's how I think of it. I mean, like, I got to grow up and just kind of had to figure a lot of things out. Yeah, you know, we went to the woods, and he taught me a lot, you know, about safety and about, you know, slipping around and, you know, different things. And and then a lot of things you just got to figure out on your own, and what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, messing things up is where you learn, you know, like when you screw it up, if that's when you got to learn from it. So the next time you don't screw it up again, you know. And if somebody answered all the questions for you, I don't know if it would be that fun, you know, like if it was just, here's exactly what you got to do, you know? But,
It was always for me growing up, it was kind of an adventure, you know, it was kind of how I looked at it. You know, I grew up in a rural area, you know, and, similar to you, my dad deer hunted, and we deer hunted growing up, but, you know, we did a lot of small game hunting too, whether it was squirrels or rabbits or whatever. But the cool thing was growing up in the middle of nowhere, I could come home from middle school and, you know, grab a shotgun out of the closet after school and be like, I'm going to go pheasant hunting today, you know, and just to your point, just go out and explore and mess it up and, you know, and just be in the woods, you know, and kind of learn a little bit on my own. That little bit of independence, you know, was good. And it's interesting that, you know, talking about slipping through quiet, you know, your dad kind of saying, you know, you got to walk like an Indian, you know, it's funny how, you know, we have all these things in hunting, like from tools, gadgets, whatever the case is. And when it comes right down to it, at the end of the day, still some of the two most effective things is the ability to be quiet and observe. You know what I mean? It comes down to like some pretty simple things to try to be successful. It's like, if you don't do those two things well, it doesn't really matter what else, what camo you have or what boots you got or whatever. It still comes down to being quiet and being still.
Right. Yeah. Which you can't go out and buy off the shelf.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so that's where a lot of the shortcuts come in, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Get the same result just with different shortcuts or whatever, but that work for different people.
So I want to transition here real quick, man. And I want to start talking just a little bit about, you know, where you're from to get a kind of a sense of, you know, the habitat and terrain. So can you just kind of paint a picture, I guess, for me of the area that you typically hunt? Is it walk-in permission access? Is it, you know, public chunks? You know, what's the habitat and terrain look like?
Currently, and for the past 6-8 years, I've just been hunting public property in Oklahoma and in Kansas. Mm-hmm. You know, in Kansas, everybody knows there's walk-in ground and there's public ground. I really don't have any permission. I don't really have any permission spots that I can think of at the moment, really. Mm-hmm. But, so, I mean, it's prairie habitat, creek bottom habitat to river bottom habitat. Northeast Oklahoma has a lot of lakes, a lot of rivers and a lot of lakes, which there's a lot of creeks flowing into all these lakes. And, so there's an unlimited amount of water, you know, shoreline, creek, river access, and obstacles. And in Kansas, you know, there's the same, you know, there's rivers, not near as many lakes and rivers up there, but you got some rivers and creeks, and then just the prairie habitat itself is a different challenge in itself when you start getting into some of the native blue stem, you know, more wide open spaces that, it's different. It's a different hunt because it's more wide open, but sometimes it's, you know, it kind of narrows down your options of where to go sit, you know, and it kind of, it's a no brainer sometimes, you know, so.
Right. So in a season, I'm expecting you're kind of probably transitioning back and forth between probably hunting from an elevated set to hunting from the ground and still hunting. Is that fair, or are you doing one more than the other?
I pretty much sit in the tree stand all the time, pretty much.
That's interesting. Yeah. I was talking to Eddie, and he said the same thing. And it's funny because I know some other fellows that have hunted, you know, the prairie area, and a lot of those guys will hunt almost exclusively from the ground. And I just find it interesting that, and look, you know, you get it done with regularity. Eddie gets it done with regularity. And then the guys that hunt from the ground that I know get it done with regularity. So for me, a guy who's going to the Kansas for the first time this year, I'm kind of looking at it going, well, man, I don't really know what my best option is going to be. You know what I mean? Like, so
yeah, I know some guys like that that, man, they get it done off the ground, and I've had some really interesting experiences off the ground. I'm not going to say I haven't. I can only really think of maybe one good buck that I took from the ground, and that was a funny story. But in Kansas, I've had some interesting things. You know, some of that was on private property back 10 years ago. But I can definitely see how guys can get it done from the ground, you know. But
what was
I'm not that confident sometimes, you know, out in the open and trying to sneak around from bush to bush.
Right. So, I mean, how much, you know, especially if you're hunting elevated a lot of the time, you know, well, let me back up for a second. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. Let me just start with, you know, when you're headed to one of these pieces, because, you know, again, this is a little bit for my own education as well. As I'm getting ready to head out there, I'm trying to absorb as much knowledge as I can. You know, what's your typical scouting process look like out there? You know, let's say it's a brand new piece to you that you've never hunted before, a piece of public or walk-in access or, you know, whatever the case is. You know, where are you starting? Because for me, when I look at it, whether it's Pennsylvania, Ohio, even when I was in Missouri or Iowa or whatever, you know, yeah, the terrain's a little bit different, but I'm still going to have elevation changes. I'm still going to have significant blocks of timber and things like that to where I have some familiarity with those things from living in Pennsylvania. So it translates. But for me, heading to somewhere like Kansas or Oklahoma, where the terrain is just so vastly different from what I'm used to, you know, I'm just curious, you know, for you, when you see a new piece and you're going to hunt this new piece of public you've never seen before, where are you starting? Are you starting online and kind of going from there? Or are you going straight boots on the ground?
I mean, I'll spend a lot of time, you know, on Google Earth, and I'll look at different places, and I'll look at them a bunch of different times, you know, throughout the year sometimes, because it's funny, like I'll look at something on Google Earth and then I'll go walk it out. Mm-hmm. And then I'll come back and look at it on Google Earth again, and then it makes better sense. And then, you know, I may go walk it out again and look at it again on Google Earth. And sometimes, like, it could be a year later, I'll pull up Google Earth and look at the same place, but I may think of something just a little differently, but, and a light bulb goes off and it's like, oh, I need to try that, you know? But, you know, a lot of times I'm trying to think where people aren't going to try to be, you know? And that's that's the hardest thing for me to figure, is where somebody else doesn't want to go. Cause you know, if you pick a good looking spot, there's usually somebody else that did too, you know? So,
yeah,
but I mean, if it's a new place, I mean, I got to look at my access. Where can I come and go from this spot? And then, you know, if there's a particular piece that seems appealing, if I walk it out and, you know, I'm like, man, that's a no brainer right there. I got to be able to get there, and then look at where I have to come from. Can I get to it safely? I can't stress enough the access coming and going is, you know, without something knowing you're doing it is as important as anything else, you know?
Yeah.
If they know you're coming, it's, you know, it's game over really.
Right.
You know, you don't really have a chance before you start. You just get, you know, the dumb rutting buck that comes by, you know, which can happen, you know?
Yeah. Or you just get, just get super, super super lucky.
And that stuff happens. I mean,
yeah,
you have to be for that stuff. You just have to be present, you know, and good stuff happens, like, you know, but you got to be there for it to happen. So.
Yeah. I'm imagining it's flat. So, I mean, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but it's super flat and, you know, not a lot of topo to kind of hide behind. So when you're talking about access, like I can envision myself, and this is just, again, a guy coming from a flatlander or a guy coming from Pennsylvania, right? Going to come to, you know, the plain states to hunt. I'm thinking about my access, and that's one thing that I've thought about. And, you know, here I'll use, you know, whether it's terrain to kind of hide behind, you know, I can envision, you know, making sure my wind is correct for access in the plains. I get it. But the part that I struggle with a little bit is how am I hiding? Like, how am I hiding myself? How am I not being skylit? How am I not, you know, kind of out in the wide open, you know, because there's not a whole lot to hide behind. So how do you, you know, give me a, I guess, walk me through what you would do to access a property. Like, you know, what's a crazy thing you might do? Are you like going to a creek bottom and just walking the creek bottom up to be hidden? But, you know, what's your approach for that?
At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
If I can come up with a plan where I feel like I am safe, and I don't care what I have to do, if I have to go out of my way to do it, like, I will do that. If I think this, you know, if me cutting across here is wrong because, like, the wind's wrong or something, if I have to go way out of my way, you know, I will, just because that's probably the most, one of the most important things for me. This is an example of one stand that I've hunted for 2 years. It's on public. It's on a little river. I can easily walk up to this stand from where I park. It's easier to walk up there. But if I were to do that, everything would know I'm coming. And I just feel, you know, that isn't going to work. You know, I could get kill something, but not, you know, I'm going to alert a lot of animals when I walk in there. So there's a river thing, and I put in my canoe and I got a paddle. It's like 3/4 of a mile up this river, completely like going the wrong direction, because there's a big oxbow that goes way out and around.
That's always fun too, well, going the wrong direction.
Right. Yeah, you go in the other direction, you know, which is, that's okay. But once I get to the end of this oxbow, there's like a massive log jam that's like too big to cross. Like, that's 100-yard log jam. Mm-hmm. So before season starts, I have to hide another kayak or canoe on the other side of this log jam. So, and I leave it there all season for the time I'm hunting, just way back off in the woods on the side of this creek or whatever. And so, you know, before the dark of the morning, I get up and I paddle about 3/4 of a mile to the log jam, have to get out, walk over the, you know, walk over this little bit of the point of the oxbow, and then get back in this other little boat that I stashed, and then paddle another little, you know, quarter to half up to my tree stand or whatever. I could easily walk up there. It's much easier, but I can do that. You know, I take one boat and get in the other boat and then paddle up there and climb out of the bank and climb up my tree, and nothing really knows I came or went. You know, I can sit there all day and then get back in my boat and float out of there, you know, and I don't feel like I damaged the place if I got to, you know, sit there again all day tomorrow or the third day, you know?
Yeah. That water access that's pretty slick, man. How far is your setup from getting out of that second boat, would you say?
They're normally like really close to the creek. Like, that creek's probably like 10 yards off the bank, you know? Mm-hmm. Because I want to just appear, you know, if I had one magical power, it would be just to teleport, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, and a lot of my setup are via canoe or kayak, and it has, you know, dealing with either going up creeks or rivers or crossing them or coves, and with the wind in my favor. And that way I feel like typically I'm like 100% safe. You know, if I have a westerly wind and I'm cutting across, you know, a body of water and hit that bank and get out and get in a tree, and my wind is blowing back across the water most of the time, like most of the time I don't ever bump anything, you know?
Right.
Sometimes there's stuff that may be there when you get there, but
right.
Like that's not too big of a deal.
Yeah. And I would imagine sitting that close to the water too, you probably get a nice little thermal pool into that river,
yeah,
whatever that body of water is, just kind of suck it right down back down the river, I'd imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Especially sitting that close on it.
I mean, that's a lot of what I look for. I mean, apparently. It's just different places that that probably have water in the way, really. You know, mm-hmm. like a long time ago, I kind of, you know, I watched Eddie do some hunting and picked up on a couple things and decided I needed to, you know, be able to try to get to where some other people weren't going to get. And, you know, yeah. I figured a certain amount of people have a boat or a canoe or something. And a certain amount of those people are actually going to get up in the dark in November and go use it, you know, and that's a few amount of people, but
yeah,
it seems to be getting more popular. Last year I saw quite a few other guys doing it and,
yeah, it has. I started. I use a kayak for some access.
Yeah.
And it's great.
But it's a good way of hunting. I mean, like it's, you know.
Yeah.
It's just a good solid way of hunting.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me, two things for me, and you hit them really. It's getting away from people. If you can just put a barrier between you and people, like one yeah. significant barrier, you just cut down on so much of the traffic you're gonna have to deal with. And then the second part is to your point, you know, for me, you know, just from my experience, I live in a suburban area. And so the public pieces we have around here aren't huge. And so if you can find a way to water access something, you know, if you find a place that, you know, maybe is unmolested and you're not getting a ton of pressure and stuff like that, man, I want to be able to hunt that thing as many times as I can, because I'm only going to have but a few spots that are like that. And if I can only hunt it once or twice a year, that's not great, you know? So, you know, boat access for that purpose where you're just hopping up off the bank. You know, I have one of those places like that myself. I actually have two this year because I just found another spot. Actually three now that I think, forgot about the other one. So, you know, so it's like a couple places where I know I can pretty much, as long as I hunt it on the right wind, you know, and don't get busted or whatever, I can pretty much hunt it as often as the wind will allow me for the whole season. And right. I should be good, you know?
Yep.
So what it is about that Oxbow setup, beyond, you know, the access is good and you're able to get away from people, you know, so you're scouting a piece of public land, you've done your boots on the ground and stuff like that. And if you want to use the Oxbow example as, you know, as an example, that's fine. If there's another idea, just as well, but what kind of sign are you really looking for that gets you excited? You know, some guys, you know, are bed hunters, right? I have a buddy who's a bed hunter. He pretty much only hunts beds. That to me, it's like, I find beds once in a while. I'm not the best bed hunter. I'll throw some hunts at him. You know, have another buddy who's a big, you know, he likes to hunt rub lines and rubs, especially in, you know, early to mid-ish October. And I myself, I'm a scrape guy. I like to hunt near and around big primary scrape areas. Some other guys really prioritize finding tracks because they're trying to find and make sure that there's a big enough, you know, animal in the area. You know, what really kind of trips your trigger when you're, you know, going through an area? What are you really looking for as potential setups?
For me, I mean, it's trying to find funnels, trying to find places that I mean, it's just a no brainer that deer are going to travel through here, you know, either because they have to, or they want to. Now typically I'm hunting rutting deer, you know, deer that are on the move, you know, I'm not a particular, like, just bed hunter. I watch some of these guys do it and I haven't evolved that skill yet. Like, I'm super interested in it, and I think there's some extremely good outdoorsmen that are out there doing it, and it's that's something I want to work on and kind of improve myself. But for now I've just been kind of a rut hunter, you know, bucks that are on the move and traveling. So I just try to sit in places that I think, you know, a male white-tailed deer is going to travel through, and in the scouting in the winter, when I go do, you know, I try to do scouting basically in the winter, and I'll go walk areas and walk as much as I can. And, you know, you'll find the big grubs or some big tracks or big scrapes. And, you know, that tells me there's good mature animals there, you know,
right. And
if there's those signpost grubs, those, I love seeing those, because that's the good deer that, you know, maybe not the same one, but there's a good deer that comes through here every year, you know, and has touched this tree for 5 years, you know, so the odds of that happening again are pretty good. And if there's a way for, you know, if there's a, and there's not always a funnel. Sometimes it's just like, you know, I may see this kind of sign along a riverbank, And if I can access that bank, you know, with the wind in my favor, I may just sit there long enough until one of them comes by, you know, just out of stubbornness. If the wind is in my favor, you know, if I can sit there more than once or twice, you know, but a lot of it's just getting into some of those spots and then being there and spending the time there, you know, during that time of year, you know, when they should be traveling and looking for does and moving up and down, you know, creeks and rivers and stuff like that.
Right. So let me ask this, when are you doing most of your hunting? Do you kind of lay low, say like in October? Is there a certain kind of time frame where you're like, all right, it's go time?
Yeah, I mean, if I had my way, I would just hunt the whole month of November, you know. But Oklahoma seasons are not set up particularly well for the bow hunter. You know, we have an archery season, and then like the second half of October is like a muzzleloader season, and that throws all the guys out there on the public. And then you have about 3 weeks typically between muzzleloader season and rifle season, which rifle starts about November 21st ish, you know. And for Oklahoma, like, that's when I have to get it done, you know, when the deer are rutting and when the guys in orange aren't out there.
Yeah.
And so that's my window. You know, I take off those 2 or 3 weeks, and I just go hit it hard. And, you know, at the same time, I'll go up to Kansas and hunt up there too. And, you know, November in Kansas is always good. You never know what you're going to run into, you know? Yeah. So it's not, I'm not saying it's easy, any easier up there, you know, but.
Right. Yeah.
You never know what you'll see.
Yeah. It's kind of like, I kind of equate, you know, and look, I've never been to Kansas, so I don't 100% know. I would imagine, though, I've hunted Iowa, and I feel my feelings prior to going to Kansas this year are similar to how I felt before I went to Iowa, which is, look, if you're trying to hunt, you know, good deer, they're not easy anywhere. Trying to hunt, you know, good deer or mature deer, that's not easy anywhere. But it's a more target-rich environment, and there's always that possibility during that time of year in November that a giant could walk out of nowhere because they're there, you know? And so that's what, you know, is exciting for me is, you know, look, I'm not going to try to kill the biggest deer this year. I'm just trying to have fun and kill a good deer. You know, so looking forward to be there. But I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that you focus primarily on when the deer are moving is when you're trying to get it done during that kind of, you know, short time frame that you have between, you know, before gun season comes in. And that you're really kind of
mainly to avoid people, you know. That,
right.
I'm just trying to avoid the most amount of people, but that's a good time of year. But if I could push rifle season back a little bit, you know, I would.
Right.
But
yeah, I hear you.
I can't.
But so you mentioned you really kind of focus on, you know, funnels and different areas and stuff like that. And so for me, again, I'm using my Pennsylvania brain here, my Northeastern brain, where I can clearly visualize what those are in this type of terrain and habitat. Mm-hmm. But help me understand what you would look for in a funnel or what might create those funnels in those areas where I don't really have a lot of topography that's going to help create them.
Right. I think you'll have more topography than you imagine or what you're expecting.
Okay.
It's not totally just flat. I mean, maybe if you're going further out west, like, I don't know where you're going exactly, but most of it's just not totally flat. So you have the rolling hills and creeks and different things. But, you know, like one stand, there's a big ridge, you know, it's a big north-south running ridge, wooded, heavily wooded ridge. And part of this creek that snakes through there, you know, and goes around and makes a big oxbow, comes back around and runs down along the base of this ridge for, you know, 200 yards or so, and then makes, you know, bends two different directions and goes the other way or whatever.
Right.
You know, that makes a bit of a funnel. Not saying that the deer have to walk down at the base of the ridge, because they don't. Sometimes they're in the middle and sometimes they're on the top. But, you know, on the north bend and the south bend, the creek bends back west, You know, where that fills out, where that ridge fills out in the creek bottom, it's just kind of a natural, it's a natural funnel, you know, where things come off that ridge, you know, and I can sit in one corner with a north, northeast wind. And then if the wind switches, I can kind of float back down the creek and get in this other tree if it switches to like a southeast wind, you know. And so, you know, that's what happened last year. The first year I hunted it, I just had the one stand for like a north, northeast. And just because it pinched up against this ridge, and I saw big rubs in there that I scouted it in the winter before and saw a big rub. And I mainly just really wanted to know what lived back there. And that's when I found the log jam and realized how much BS I was going to have to go through to get back there. Like, I wasn't really sure if I was going to do it or not, but like I told myself I would. And then like eventually I did, and you know. So the curiosity killed the cat. I had to get back there to know what made that rub, you know. So I sat a year, you know, and realized, well, you know, what happens if the wind switches? I got to like get down and get all the way out of here because I don't have any other option. But I can hang one right back behind me, you know, and get in that one for a south, southeast or whatever. And so that happened this year. You know, I sat in that tree, northeast wind, and then middle of the day, the wind switched, and I got down and went to the other tree. And at 1 p.m., you know, I ended up shooting a deer out of the other tree just out of randomness, you know, so.
Right.
But it was
that willingness.
You know, And there's a little more detail to that story that I'll explain later that maybe that I feel, you know, was a big contributor to that happening, but
right.
But other funnels, I mean, you know, we're in Kansas especially, I mean, some of it's no-brainers where you just have some, you know, big creek bottoms that are running up through massive, you know, prairie country and stuff. And if it's like a big, you know, north-south drainage, like the whole drainage is kind of a funnel, you know, like if you're sitting along it with an east wind or a west wind blowing, not going up and down the drainage, you know, like those deer are going to travel up and down that stuff looking for does. If it's an east-west drainage, you know, you got an easy north-south type setup, you know.
Right.
As far as picking the exact spot, you know, that's when you kind of can walk up and down that drainage and maybe notice, you know, the rubs or the scrapes or, you know, a particular thing that would choke them down to, instead of 100-yard area, maybe half of that, you know, if it's a big blow down trees or, you know, a ditch or something like that. But,
Those drainages are interesting because I know whenever I was talking to Eddie, he was talking about, or we talked about it just a little bit. And, you know, I was asking him just about October hunts and stuff like that, because we have a mutual friend that likes to, when he hunts and takes his trips, you know, a mutual friend of ours does it pretty much in, you know, in October before the, you know, the rut pressure rolls in anywhere. And this mutual friend of ours suggested I consider going to Kansas in October, because he was like, you know, you can probably still get something that's on a bed to food pattern. You could probably glass one up, watch them for like a day or two, and then go in and try to intercept. And so I was asking Eddie a little bit just about, like, you know, where he's found, you know, bedding or where he's potentially hunted beds. And what he had mentioned was in those drainages. And he said, if you go back, and I'm just curious if you've had a similar kind of experience. He said, if you go back and maybe follow like a drainage, you know, almost like a river or a stream would have like a secondary or third kind of branch off of it. And he was like, if you go back into those areas, he's like, that's where I've typically found, you know, bucks bedded. So using your example, if you got an east-west drainage, you know, those secondary kind of branches would be those, you know, those north or south facing branches, so to speak. And
right.
It didn't dawn on me until after he had mentioned it, because we have something similar around here where it's like, if you're hunting ridge country, you might have an east-west running ridge, and you're going to have a bunch of secondary kind of ridges that come off that are like north and south ridges. And now a lot of times that's where you'll find bucks bedded. And so it's literally like the same topography feature, only inverted. And I'm just curious, do you see some similar things to that, where like those secondary kind of branches off of those drainages, are those kind of like areas that maybe are good funnels or good places to kind of check?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's right, and he knows more about deer than most people.
Right.
But But yeah, you know, and I think, you know, kind of what he's saying is, you know, some of those bucks, and especially mature bucks, like to get out by themselves, you know, mm-hmm. and have some peace and quiet, and they'll get up in the head of one of those drainages and out there in some places that you wouldn't really expect them to be, you know. Mm-hmm. But there's a reason they're there, because like you can't really get to them, you know. Like if they can, they lay there and can smell one wind direction, and then they can, you know, look the other direction, you know, and they're just laying underneath one little tree on a pond dam, you know, at the head of a little prairie draw, you know, like they're pretty smart. Like they've mm-hmm. they got it figured out. but you know, in the same time, you know, they will get up and go to cruising and go down that drainage, or, you know, and it's not the main part of some drainages. It's the little fingers, like he's talking about, that they'll go troll around in looking for those does, and they'll have some, we call them plum thickets. They may have a better name for them, but mm-hmm. you know, they'll have some of that thick habitat in the head of those draws. And a lot of times where maybe two of those little draws maybe come close to, you know, creating a saddle basically from one drainage to another.
Right.
Like those Kansas deer don't have any problem, you know, hopping over those saddles and going from this drainage and hopping over to that one and cruising down that one and then making a tour, you know?
Yeah.
And I've hunted in some places that, you know, think outside the bubble or off the wall, or, you know, seem crazy because, you know, you may be out in the tree in the thicket out in the wide open or whatever, but like sometimes that's where they're at, you know?
And that's the one thing Eddie had mentioned too. Like, so give me, have you had some scenarios like that where it was just like you set up in a spot where even you thought to yourself, like, what am I doing here?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like, yeah, for sure. Some of the spots I still sit, once I get there, I'm like, man, this sucks. Like, what in the world? This is like I promise, like one of the trees where I've killed some good deer, every time I go there, I'm like, this is the suckiest spot in the state of Oklahoma. Like this is terrible. It's terrible. And it's all you can do to make yourself sit there. But I know it works. Then, like, I have to sit there because it's worked too many times now, you know, like.
Yeah. But, well, what's different about that spot?
That particular spot, it's like a, you know, it's a south wind spot. It's on a, you know, a tributary of water. And basically but it makes a little bend there. So the creek just makes a big enough, it's a north-south running creek, but it makes just big enough bend west where I can sit there and have my wind blow south and blow basically straight up the creek mm-hmm. without it going straight up the bank, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what caught my eye. That was it about that spot. But there was a little funnel feature to it because there was like an overflow pond, you know, not too far off the river, which made like a 20-yard pinch point, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what caught my eye originally, was like that is a very narrow spot, but the deer don't really travel past that much. They kind of turn around.
So would you hunt that on a north wind? Is that what you said?
So I hunt it with a south wind. Like a
south wind.
I'm on the west side of this creek and it goes up and bends west just 100 yards maybe, and then turns back north.
And so
there's just a little stretch there that I can sit with the south, southwest, you know, type wind. I can sit west is safe, but.
And I'm guessing deer are coming from the north on that setup?
They're mainly coming from the south. So I'm sitting there with my wind blowing south and my scent blowing north. And I think the deer are probably somewhere southerly of of where I'm sitting, you know. And it's kind of a, you know, block of timber that comes up and kind of peters out at this pond. And the original reason I sat there was just because the safety of wind. I needed the south wind. I needed the place to sit safely with the south wind.
Yeah.
You know, along this bank where I think deer are going to travel.
Just really interesting because, I mean, that south wind, like they've almost got to be partially tailwinded, right, to get there, right?
Well, I mean, if they're south of, you know, if they're south or southwest of me and the wind's blowing south-southwest, it's blowing away from them,
right?
You know,
yeah,
and blowing it back back up the water, basically, right. Back up the river or creek or whatever. I think the first year I sat there, I saw a decent little rub, and that, you know, got me excited. And I sat there. I don't even know if I saw deers the first year I sat there. But the next few years, I sat there, and I think when the wind's out of the south, deer kind of naturally, you know, deers have their different bedding areas depending on their wind direction, you know.
Yeah.
And I think when the wind's out of the south, they kind of migrate up this direction towards this end of this habitat, you know.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that would make sense, because then they would have they would be able to smell pretty much everything if they're bedding.
Yeah. So I think they work, you know, they work their way up here, and then they have it in their advantage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched them do it. Like last year, there was a little buck that came in, and he came in, and I watched them go around the whole little area and kind of smell over here and smell over here, and he got it completely in his favor. And then kind of went back into the wind about 100 yards and bedded down, like, right in front of me. But
that's funny, because my next question was going to be, I was going to say, like, well, why do you think that they're there? But then once you mentioned, you know, that they're possibly coming up there to bed, I was like, well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because then they've got the wind.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think when the wind, you know, favorable for them, they work their way up into this area, and then the wind's in their face with a south wind, and, you know, they're doing the same thing I'm doing, basically.
Right.
As I've sat there over the years, like, mm-hmm. I've killed 4 good deer over there. And I know it's a bedding area in which, you know, bucks are going to come check these does and stuff. But, like, it's like a breeding spot. Mm-hmm. Like, there's spots where bucks will push does, you know, and eventually kind of keep an eye on them or manage them, or, you know, not let them get away, you know.
Yeah.
And kind of make them submit, or let her get comfortable, and then she'll submit, basically. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those spots, because I've seen it 3 or 4 times now where a good buck will bring a doe in here and then just kind of back off, and he'll let her be comfortable and let her relax, and she may go bed down in a thicket, and he may go stand there or lay down next to her. And she may get up, and he'll get up, and, you know, he's being pushy, but he's not, you know, and he's just kind of letting her relax, really.
Yeah.
And I mean, about three different bucks that I can think of have done that in this exact same spot. And, it's probably just because it's a bedding area, and they know to come up there and check for him, but it's also, it must be a really sanctuary, safe feeling place for them to push up in there and then get relaxed enough to, you know, to breed and all that stuff.
Yeah. So, or the buck knows he can kind of cut them out up there and not really get bothered by other bucks, you know, cause I know that was one thing Eddie was mentioning too, was just around that. Cause I forget which deer it was that he killed. I think it was like a big deer he killed in that blue stem. He said was out in the middle of nowhere. He said, but there, he just kept seeing this buck like out here that he thought that this deer would be out here. And he was literally just cutting a doe out and brought it out there to breed her. And that's where he would cut.
Yeah.
He would bring does to it. And he said it was in the middle of like nothing, you know, it was like literally nothing. Like there were the one tree he could get into and that was it, you know, and everything else was just, you know, blue stem grass, I guess is what you guys, I don't know what that looks like, but you know, and that's why he set up there. So that makes sense. It seems like that's, you know, I mean, I know that happens in other places. I don't know if it's in like, you know, real thick timber or whatever, that it's a little harder to find or see. I saw that whenever I was in Iowa, there was one particular deer that I've saw that for a couple, I missed him actually twice, which sucked. But he actually, I think it was the third time I'd seen him. I guess the third and fourth time I'd seen him, he had a doe that he had cut out and he was just spending time in this one particular area. And it seems like they almost have, like, especially those mature deer, where they might cut something out and take them off away, even if it's outside of like an area they might typically be, you know, they just have this little spot where it's like a hidey hole that they're going to, like, I got my girl, I'm going to take her so I don't get bothered. And then I'll be back in the game once I'm done.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm not so sure the does don't, you know, aren't just as a part of that as well. Like they want to be comfortable too, you know?
Yeah.
And I think they like to go off into a secluded place, a brush pile, the head of a prairie draw, you know, somewhere that, you know, they can relax and then be comfortable or whatever instead of just being ran to death.
Yeah. I know. If you have the option, do you want to be run to death or would you like to go lay down? I would opt for lay down.
Yeah. I've seen it, you know, in some of the Kansas deer, like he mentioned, and they will. I mean, they just act like a cutting horse, and mm-hmm. they'll just cut them off. And once they get them out in some of that open country, like there's no getting away. Like, you know, some of those bucks are so agile. It's pretty neat to watch. I watched it happen once in Oklahoma, along a river, mm-hmm. and that was probably one of the like National Geographic moments. Like, I watched this doe and this buck pile off into a river, and she was running from him, and he was chasing her like a cutting horse. And they swam across the river and got, you know, where they could run in the water, but on the beach. And like, she would run as fast as he could, and he would run like twice as fast and cut her off. And she would turn, and he would be there. And they eventually ended up, you know, in the woods on my side or whatever. And once they got to the cover, he backed off and he just let her relax, you know, and he stood about 40 yards away and she just kind of relaxed and fed along, and he'd grunt and, you know, rub his antlers on some branches or whatnot sometimes, but he wasn't just still pushing. He knew that, like, she wanted to be over here, and he was good with that, you know, and he was keeping an eye on her, and she wasn't going anywhere, and, you know,
right.
And that's where they were going to do their thing. But
nice. Yeah. That would be cool to see. Like, that's,
that was awesome.
Yeah, man. I'm curious, you know, I'm always, especially, you know, hunting somewhere outside of PA, because I mean, there's just a ton of pressure here. So a lot of times, you know, calling and things like that are probably more harm than good in a lot of cases around here in certain instances. You know, do you do a fair amount of calling, you know, or no calling? Like, what's your, you know, approach to that?
Yeah, I do a little bit of calling, you know, a little bit of grunting, and then I'll throw in a little bit of rattling every now and then. I've had more success, you know, kind of rattling in a deer in Kansas more than I have really in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. It probably just depends on the pressure and the seasons and how these deer get hunted differently than some of those up there, because they get the muzzleloader season and all that, you know. But I don't call a lot. I mean, I don't like do the snort wheezing and all that stuff. I mean, I'll let out a little grunt every now and then, and I'll clank my antlers. I got a, you know, pretty good set of antlers that have a good sound to them, and I'll hit those, you know, once or twice throughout the course of a all day sit, you know, like in the morning sometime and maybe in the evening sometime. But
right.
I've rattled in a lot of good deer before, you know. In Kansas, I've seen deer and then rattled to them and had great responses and had them, you know, come in on a string before.
Right.
Have you
found you've had more success rattling in the morning or the evening, or are you not really, really sure? Because I know some folks that they have different feelings about when rattling works for them.
Right. I don't know if I had a particular one. I don't know if I've really thought about it, if one worked better in the morning or the evening.
I'm just curious.
I'm not sure exactly. Yeah, I mean, I've done it at all times, really. I mean, and so
now I've put something in your brain. You have to kind of pay attention to it this year and see what happens.
In Oklahoma, I don't really rattle a whole lot. If it is, it's just to make a little bit of just enough noise to, you know, I'm not simulating two bucks fighting, really. Just a little bit of antler noise, you know, to get something curious, maybe. But
right, a little bit of light sparring to say, hey, there's a couple of deer in the area type of thing.
Yeah.
Any decoying for you, man? Do you ever get into using decoys?
No, I never have. No. I never have. Or fence or anything like that. Just, I, you know, pretty much just try to hunt the wind, mm-hmm. you know, keep the wind in my favor and, like, get into a spot and get out of a spot. So
right. I mean, if you're doing those things right, you're typically ahead of the game in general.
Right.
You know, in a lot of cases, because a lot of people's hunts kind of stop before they even begin because of those things specifically, you know?
Yeah. Keep it simple. I try to keep it simple, and that's my approach. I don't do a lot of trail cameras really. I mean, I have some and I put them up, sometimes and got pictures every now and then, but I don't really use them or rely on them.
Just relying on like the sign that you see and stuff like that to kind of qualify if there's a good deer in the area and stuff.
Just hunt kind of how we would if we didn't have all this stuff, really, kind of right. Picking a terrain feature, maybe scouting it, saying, yeah, there's deer sign here, there's good deer sign here. If I sit here, I could be, with the wind in my favor, this might work. And then actually just go do it and see if it actually works,
Right.
No. For me, I don't do enough cameras to feel like I'm being productive. Sometimes I feel like I'm unproductive. If I don't get a picture, then I might get frustrated. Or if I feel like they know I'm there. Like each time I go in there, if I want to check that thing or something like that, I may go hang one in one spot that I hunt, but like, I never want to go check it unless I actually go there to hunt,
Yeah.
And then I don't really want to get out and walk 20 yards over there because like,
ground
that puts sin on the ground that something might walk by while I'm sitting here today. So,
I think the approach that you take is pretty, results speak for themselves. It's a solid approach. Your style, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but your style is more of surprise. You want to be there before they ever know that you've potentially ever been there. And you want the first encounter to be the one where an arrow goes off essentially is it, there's something super cool about that just from the perspective of, when you walk into a place, man, you don't know what deer necessarily is around the corner per se, and that is kind of exciting. That's the one thing I always kind of enjoy about hunting out of state is because I don't know what deer are possible. I'm reading sign, trying to figure it out. And I think there's a good one here, but who knows what's going to walk by me. I'm just going to try to set up the best hunt I can and see what happens. And I think that's something that I think folks get away from some. And I think, it's always good to add some of that back into your life, in my opinion.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a couple different ways of hunting and getting the job done. And that's where I'm at. And, some guys have different resources than others and, that's just how I know to do it. It's just kind of the work at it and feel like I'm safe going into a place and then kind of put my faith into that and put my time in and see what happens, And there's a lot of satisfaction when it does work, There's a lot of satisfaction that comes with that,
Yeah. And there's conviction in what your eyes are telling you too, And I think that's one thing that people, get away from to a degree is they let their eyes kind of lie to them or they don't believe their eyes, so to speak. And I think that's something hard to do. And I don't think that comes, that only comes with time and scouting and seeing a lot of stuff, it's like, you have to kind of build that confidence up.
Yeah. Just like you said, time and experience and learning from all that stuff. Like you said, kind of seeing with your eyes and believing what you're seeing. And there's another part of that, which is like I mentioned kind of when we visited before, is just your gut feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Hunting by feel and hunting by intuition and listening to that stuff. I could go through a lot of my deer stories and give you an encounter where, I had a gut feeling and so I followed this decision and later something grand came out of it,
Right.
And it may not be a big decision at the moment, but afterwards you kind of look back and you're like, wow, if I hadn't done that, like this may have never happened, and it's just listening to yourself, listening to your gut and kind of, and following that sometimes, but.
Yeah. So I'm curious, man, we're going to pivot here a little bit. So we kind of learned about the area you're hunting and some of the things you're looking for and stuff like that.
just not to bring Eddie back into this, but you know, he mentioned to me when we got off the phone, you know, when we were just kind of chatting, he said, I know this fella, Travis, that is probably one of the most consistent fellas that I know, you know, as far as like being able to get it done. And, you know, it just, and it just, he's consistent, right? He works at it and yeah. It puts the effort in and the work is done. And then it's leading to this consistency that he has and killing good deer on public land. And so I'm just curious, you know, and it might be some of these little decisions that you talked about that you made. And so if it is, then we can just dive into that. But, you know, if you had to kind of think about your approach to hunting overall, like, what do you think, you know, what do you think kind of when you, let me put it this way, I guess, when you reflect on a season past, you've been successful or multiple seasons, right? You know, what do you feel leads to some of that consistency that you're having, that you're seeing whenever you're out there trying to put an arrow in something? Hard question. I know, man, put you on the spot.
Well,
sorry.
I mean, so the biggest consistency for me is where all this comes from. I mean, like I give credit to God for everything that he, you know, produces and gives to me. And when I go and sit, that's a lot of my strategy, is just knowing that he is, you know, the creator and controller of all these things, of us and of them. And, you know, I believe you reap what you sow, you know, you do good and hopefully you get repaid. And, you know, but when I go and, you know, sit in some of these places, I know that I can put in the work and put in the effort. And, you know, like luck is preparation meets opportunity. You know, I can shoot my bow all summer, I can hang my stand, but when it comes down to, you know, the day, you know, you got to go get in that stand and you got to sit there and you got to do your part and be there. And once I get to any of these spots, whichever way the wind blows, whatever stand I end up in that day, once I get there, like, I mean, I have a realization and I know that, like, I have no control over this because, you know, I'm not baiting them. I'm not really, I don't know who they are. I don't have a nickname for them or anything like that. I just know that there's, you know, some of his animals that live here. And if he wants me to have one, like, and be a good steward of it, you know, then he'll send one by. And if, however that may be, if it's a lone buck on a cruise, if it's a doe that changes her mind and, you know, comes this way instead of that way, you know, I've just seen too many amazing things to not believe that he really just blesses me with a lot of this stuff. Because, like I said, I could mention off probably all of my stories and you know, he'd probably say, wow, that makes sense, you know. So right. But and that's a lot of it. I mean, like, all I can do is put in some work, put in some effort, you know, and get there.
Yeah.
But once I'm there, like, I don't have any control, you know, of any of these animals. Like, you know, I can't call them all to me, you know, I can't do anything, you know. So you feel helpless once you get there. And it's just like, man, and as you sit there for hours and hours and days, you start, you know, asking for some help. It's like, you know, hey Lord, like I could really use some help, you know, like, yeah. I know I've been trying to do this all on my own and you'll let me, like, you'll let me carry the weight of the world on my shoulders. But, like, you know, if you ask for help, he'll help you. And it's just, I've seen it a few different times where I'm like, you know, this year is terrible. This year is going to suck. I don't know if there's any deer around. Like, you really might need to help me this year, buddy, you know,
right.
And something like amazing will happen. And then it happens and you're like, wow, that just happened. And like, you are amazing, you know?
I mean, that's a great answer. Like, because it's one of my favorite things about being in the timber. And I think sometimes we get caught up in like the strategy of it and like what the wind doing and what's the third, like all those things are important, but right. it's those moments of clarity that you get to have whenever you're, when you're able to be there and be present, you know,
yeah.
I think,
yeah.
And that to me is like the part that we oftentimes lose sight of, right. Is don't be an observer, be a participant, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's a good,
you know, and I don't know, like it's those moments whenever I, you know, where I kind of take stock in that, is to your point, is when something really cool happens, whether I stick an arrow in it or not, it's usually something really cool happens. I get to experience something that I've not ever experienced before.
Well, most guys, you know, a lot of people get caught up in and lose focus over why we're out there, or, you know, why we should be out there, if it's, you know, trying to keep up with somebody else, or, you know, everybody's on the inches and big antlers and stuff like that. And, you know, and that runs a lot of guys' hunts, you know, like I've seen it frustrate a lot of guys where they go out and they don't meet somebody else's expectations, you know, and then that's not what it's about, you know, and the size of the buck, I mean, it really doesn't matter. They're nice to have, they're awesome to look at, and they look cool. And but like, after it's all said and done, like that really wasn't, you know, the whole purpose of it, you know? And it's easy to get lost in the world of, you know, this industry now, the hunting world, you know, with the video and keeping up with the market or whatever. But,
Those things are fleeting. But at the end of the day, are fleeting, like, for sure.
I mean, at the end of the day, like that, it's not about the size of the deer. It's just, it's about the memory. It's about, you know, the whole experience of it, like you said, and being present and living in that moment. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is a perfect time. I just have like two more things for you. I think, being present in the moment and making those memories. So what I wanted to see if you could do is if you would be willing or could share a specific hunt that sticks out to you when you look back, that you really felt that this was a moment where either you learned an important lesson, it helped you become a better hunter, or something along the, or something that might've just been a really cool hunt. Do you have anything like that that sticks out to you?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'll just touch on, you know, last year's season. I killed a couple, you know, nice deer. I hunted in Oklahoma, out of that south wind stand I was talking about, and ended up shooting a good deer, what I thought to be in the liver. You know, it was back and it was low, and he didn't go very far, and he looked ill. He looked sick, you know. I backed out, and I waited like 6 hours before I came back, and me and my brother started looking for him, and we ended up, you know, jumping him up. He didn't go very far, and we ended up jumping him up a second time. And then after that, he made it to this weed field, and, you know, I lost him out there. I spent the next 2 days kind of looking for him through that weed field, trying to figure out where he had went, and, you know, never really figured that out. So I think by the third day, you know, it was time to go get back in a tree, and I went up to Kansas and shot this other good deer in the exact same place. Like, in the liver, and he had the exact same reaction. He didn't go very far, and he looked very sick. It was 1 p.m., you know, and so I backed out, and I didn't come back until the next morning. You know, I knew 6 hours obviously wasn't long enough, and I had a good feeling he was going back to his bed, and so I wanted to let him get there, and hopefully he was there the next morning, you know. So I go back the next day, and I make it to that bed. He's not in it. I do see a drop of dried blood, and I see a drop of semi-dried blood, which led me to believe he was there that morning, and he got up and walked out when he saw me walking in. And so I walked up, you know, to the top of this ridge and looked around a little bit where, you know, just on a whim where I thought he might go through some thickets or whatnot, and I didn't see him. So long story short, I walked like 5 miles, looking around this weed field and thorn field, you know, just randomly searching. And I found his second bed, which was maybe 100 yards from his first bed, and there was a drop of blood in it. I'd go back to this point, and then I would, you know, I'd venture off and go search and then come back to this and regroup and just kind of search this whole area. And, you know, at the end of the day, it was getting 3 o'clock or so. I had about one more good long search before sunset. And, you know, throughout the day, I never really got like discouraged and down. You know, it's real easy to get discouraged and give up and, you know, think, you know, what you're seeing is terrible. Like there was very little blood, you know, and then you call your buddies and you're like, well, I did this. He acted like this. You know, this is what I'm seeing. And they're like, yeah, that doesn't sound too good, man. You know, like, and it's discouraging. But in the back of my mind, I always just kind of felt like I wasn't going to give up. And throughout that day of walking through all the thorns, you know, I was just kind of like, you know, Lord, just kind of guide my feet, you know, just help me with my decision making here and there and just, you know, take me where I need to go. And so I was laying in his bed, you know, kind of just relaxing, figuring out what I needed to do. And I was like, I need to go one more good walk. And I stood up, and about 20 yards away, there's a doe standing there. And she's like 10 yards off of this trail that I've already walked down. There's a deer trail, and then she's just off of it a little bit. And she's 20 yards from me. And I kneel down, and she kind of eventually gets nervous and leaves. And I was like, well, I wonder what she was standing by. And I was like, I'm going to walk over there. And I walk over there, and there's this deer laying there. And he's dead. And he's 25 yards from where I've been looking all day long, you know. Like, I walk 5 miles around him, and he's 25 yards from where I've been laying, you know, looking. And it was just like, I broke down in tears because it was just like, the satisfaction of not really giving up, you know, and knowing that, you know, he kept a good attitude. And it was like, it was just kind of a test of like, you know,
of will.
You know, not giving up, not getting discouraged, not getting down at the mouth, not, you know, being like, dang it, you know, and just kind of going and going and going. And then it was like, he was like, you've been good, you know, like, here you go.
Right.
You know, you can have him back. Like, you're going to hang on to this guy, and you're going to be a good steward to him. Like, yeah, you can have him back, you know?
Yeah.
And man, I was so grateful.
Yeah.
And so I brought him home and dealt with him, and then ran right back up to the deer camp or whatever. And was going to get back in the stand, you know, and the next day I was going to go get in that Southwind stand where I wounded that first deer and hunt a little bit and then get down and go look for him. And that time it was time to get down, and my brother was supposed to meet me and all this stuff, and I didn't want to bother his hunt. And I was like, you know, don't worry about it today. We'll do it tomorrow. Like, I'm going to go take this tree stand down. That's, you know, it's about a mile up the river or whatever. And so I walked up the river in the middle of the day and like took my, you know, I didn't walk or paddle actually.
Right.
But took my canoe up the river or whatever, and took my stand down, and you know, that was kind of the end of the day. I may have hunted that evening, whatever. So the next day comes, and I'm going to, same game plan. I'm going to sit, and then we're both going to go look for this deer. We're going to beat this weed field down. You know, he's got to be out there somewhere. And just as a reference from where I shot the deer, let's just say he ran 400 yards south, you know. Right. And so this tree stand I took down was a mile north, so opposite direction. So I get down on that Thursday, and I was like, well, I need to go look for this deer. And then I remembered I'd left like this machete that was laying on the river up there when I took my stand down a mile up the river, like a $20 machete from Academy. But my daughter had got it for me for Father's Day, like 5 years ago or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, my daughter's name is Easton, you know, so she got named after the arrows a long time ago.
That's awesome.
But so I was like, oh man, I was like, Easton got me that machete. I need to go get it, you know.
Mm.
And it's a mongoloid of a walk, you know. And
yeah.
So I walk up there and I get my machete, and I'm just kind of walking back. I was like, I'll do a little, you know, November fresh deer scouting, you know, on my way back. Like, just look at some of this deer sign while I head back down that way to go look for my deer. And I'm going, and I'm about halfway back. So I'm, you know, I'm still 500-600 yards north of my stand or whatever, which that deer had ran like 400-500 yards south, right? And I'm just in some big, like, tall yellow grass flooded, you know, stuff, and along the river, and kind of walk off in this little depression, and there was like a couple of cottonwood trees, and I walked up in there, and like I just had this feeling, and I was like, this feels like a good place for something to like lay down and die. Mm-hmm. And I looked over and like at the base of this cottonwood tree is this, I see a deer's rib cage. And I'm like, well, there's a dead deer. And I walk over there and it's this, it's my buck that I had shot 10 days earlier.
Jeez.
And I, you know, for not 10 full days looking, you know, from the day I shot him to 2 days looking to this, you know, I'd been looking and I had my bow in my hand the whole time, you know,
right.
And I'd been looking for this deer actively to try to, you know, find them and get them. And then, you know, here I go walking up the river and I come back and all I've got is the machete in my hand and it hit me. And it's like, you know, and again, I never really got down in the mouth about this deal either. I was, you know, bummed about the situation, but I wasn't, you know, I hadn't given up.
Right.
I didn't really expect to find them, but the story wasn't over. I didn't feel like it was over, like he was gone, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was standing there and it was like the same feeling of like, you know, you've been good. And here he is. And like, now you have the right tool to remove, you know, basically what you can salvage, you know, cause the coyotes had got to him and he was 10 days old and, right. You know, the meat obviously wasn't as good, but you know, I'd been walking around with a bow and arrow looking for him and I wasn't really going to be able to remove his head with that, you know, but, you know, if I had not left that machete, you know, on accident the day before, you know,
would have never made it there.
And if I hadn't decided to walk up there and get it,
yeah,
just because my daughter bought it for me, you know,
yeah,
like well, you can't make that stuff up. You know?
Yeah. That I feel like that's her deer though. Right.
Do what?
I said, I feel like that's her deer then, yeah. Right?
she gets her own deers for sure. Yeah.
Nice, man.
But I mean, that one was just like, I don't know how to like, I couldn't make that up, you know.
That's
and
crazy.
Certain
man.
Little things happen, and it's a gut feeling of yeah, you should go get that, you know.
Yeah.
And it would be really easy to be like, no, I'm not going to walk up there and get that. I'll just go buy a new one, you know.
Yeah.
But it's so just much listening of, to those little things.
It's so much of success in general, not just deer hunting, but just in life in general, is doing the little things. It's the things that people don't pay attention to, and that people aren't going to get. Recognition from,
right.
You know, and those are the things that a lot of folks don't want to do because there's not an immediate reward to it, immediate gratification from it.
Right.
But the secret sauce, in my opinion, here we're getting all philosophical, but secret sauce, in my opinion, to life is all those little things. It's everyone. Yep. It's every single one of them. It's, you know, because those are the things that lead to those, I guess moments of meaning that you'll have, you know, whether it's in the deer woods or with your family or whatever it is. Those are the important things because those are the things that are overlooked. And those are also the things of that the people you care most about recognize, you know, it's like, it's not like taking the family on the big vacation. It's being present at the dinner table. It's not buying your daughter a fancy car on her 16th birthday. It's being there for her year 1 through 16 when she needed you. It's all those things, you know? And so, man, that's a killer story, dude. I have one more question for you. I almost feel like I shouldn't even ask it. Cause I feel like that was such a good ending, but,
you're fine.
one last question. And this is a fun one. I always like to end with this one, man. Cause I always just like to get people's perspectives on, you know, their hunting circle, but you know, 3-on-3 basketball, you're familiar with I don't know if you watch much basketball, but like a 3-on-3 tournament, you know, pickup game. If you had to build a 3-on-3 basketball tournament with nothing but deer hunters, and the goal of that team was to kill, you know, good deer on public ground like your life depended on it, who would those three hunters you would pick to be on your team?
Oh, man. Obviously, probably Eddie and my brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then do you have one? Do you have one more?
As far as like somebody famous or something.
Oh no, they don't have to be famous. Doesn't matter. Just you know, it was how I found out about you was I asked Eddie the same question. He put you on his team. So
yeah, he put me on his team. Oh dang, man! The guy, one of the guys I you know that I learned a lot from. He's not here anymore. You know, if I were to could pick anybody, I would say Bert. Mm-hmm. You know, an old buddy of mine he was good at what he did for sure. Nice. Man, as far as somebody nowadays, you know.
No, Bert's fine, man. They don't have to be with us. They can be people who are no longer with us, man. I think that that's perfect.
Yeah.
Eddie, your brother, yeah. And Bert, man. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Killer.
Albert Nitz was his name. He used to run an archery shop in Bartlesville and stuff like that. I used to shoot archery competition and stuff for him. And he would be like this guy you describe as a silent killer. One of the guys that was extremely good at what he did and nobody ever heard about it.
Well,
he was one of those guys.
Nice. Well, hopefully a couple people hear of him today.
Yeah.
You know, listen to this. Absolutely. And hey man, I appreciate you coming on, sharing your stories with me. Honestly, this conversation was refreshing, man. Just your approach. It's, you know, salt of the earth kind of approach, man, that, you know, you don't get a lot of, you know, in these days, so to speak. Your grit, your work ethic and your faith and humility. It's inspiring, man. I just appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you having me, and feel free to call me anytime if you want to talk beer.
Sounds good, buddy.
All right, folks, that is a wrap for today's show. I'd like to thank all of you for listening. And if you haven't yet, please head over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star rating. And hell, while you're at it, head over to YouTube and give us a sub there too. I'd be super appreciative if you'd be able to do those two things for me. And before I shut this thing down, I need to give a big shout out to our partners who continue to help us make this podcast possible. Tethered, Exodus Outdoor Gear, Skull Brew Coffee Company, and Maven Optics. And until next time, we'll see y'all.
Gear up for the hunting season with Tethered. Right now, you can save 15% site-wide on all your favorite gear at tetherednation.com. Whether you need a set of one sticks, Skeledor sticks, a saddle, or accessories, Tethered has you covered. Plus, don't miss out on the incredible saddle bundles for the Phantom, Phantom Elite, and the Ultra Lock. Each come with ropes, sticks, and a platform, along with a few other accessories. Get free shipping on orders over $499 and make the most of these summer deals. I've been using Tethered since they launched. My primary kit currently includes the Ultra Lock saddle, one sticks, the Predator CFX carbon platform, and the Fast Pack, all from Tethered. Visit tetherednation.com and elevate your hunting game with Tethered today while the sale lasts.
All right, gang, the new Truth merch is in stock at truthfromthestand.com and on YouTube below any of the Truth from the Stand videos. I've got some new hats, beanies, t-shirts, long sleeve t-shirts, and sweatshirts. There's even a new do hard shit hat for those of us who like to embrace microdosing adversity. So head to truthfromthestand.com and check out the new gear and use the code TRUTH, TRUTH, and save yourself some cash on the new gear.